today I'm joined by Education Minister Hikia Barata, and we want to highlight some new education data. So education has been a big focus for me as Prime Minister because I believe every New Zealand child deserves the best education possible. A good education leads to better jobs, higher incomes, and generally a better quality of life, which is what we want for all New Zealand children. To achieve this, our government is investing more in education than ever before. We've introduced national standards so that parents, teachers and principals know how students are doing at school. We're building new schools, investing in ultra-fast broadband and targeting resources the kids who need the most. Today we'll be releasing new data that shows more students are leaving school with better qualifications. Provisional NCEA results show that nearly 77% of students left school last year with NCEA level 2 or more. That's an increase of more than 10 points since we came into office in 2008. Māori and Pacific students are also doing much better. Nearly 59% of Māori students left school last year with at least NCEA level 2. That's up from 44% in 2008. But the biggest increase in performance has come from Pacific students. Nearly 72% of Pacifica students left school last year with at least NCEA level 2, up from 55% in 2008. These results confirm the approach our government is taking is the right one. Over the last 5 years, we've focused on collecting data from across the whole education system so we can determine how it's performing and where we need to target resources. This helps us identify the best support for students through programs such as Pacific Power Up, Youth Guarantee and Trade Academies. As part of our Better Public Service targets, we have set ourselves a goal that 85% of 18-year-olds will have achieved NCEA Level 2 or an equivalent qualification in 2017. This has encouraged schools and communities to set their own targets and really focus on achieving them. So we've achieved a lot in the 5 years National has been in government, but of course there's a lot more to do. There are some great teachers in our classroom who are doing a great job with our children. As I announced last month, the next stage in our plan to raise achievement is to recognise excellent teachers and principals, keep good teachers in the classroom and share expertise across schools. We're investing $359 million over the next 4 years into creating new roles in schools, which will help keep our best teachers in the classroom and strengthen leadership across our schools. We're establishing a new professional teachers body, we've introduced Education Excellence Awards, and we're also hosting education festivals and the International Summit on the Teaching Profession. So now I'll pass over to Hikia, she'll make a few comments. We take any questions you want, then we'll go back to the...
Thank you, Prime Minister. So just to pick up where the Prime Minister has left off, there's been a range of work that's gone on in the last 5 years, and we have a full programme for 2014 as well. It's all based on what the best evidence is telling us, which is that the two factors that make the most difference in school as opposed to out of school, in school is the quality of teaching and the quality of leadership. And out of school, it's the strength of parents' involvement with their child's learning and the expectations that communities hold of young people. And so we've been working on all of this. In the quality teaching area that has seen us achieve a 2.5% increase overall in the last 12 months of NCEA, but a 7% increase amongst Pacific students and a 4% increase amongst Māori students has been better targeting with the resources that make the difference. We piloted an approach in 2012, which basically went in and worked with secondary schools on how they could use their data better. And we increased that range of schools involved last year, and we will increase it again this year. And it is about how schools themselves keep data on where their students are at in relation to NCEA and what resource they need to put around them. That's included having NZQA workshops with parents so that they can understand the National Certificate of Educational Achievement so that their children can choose good achievement standards that will build an 80-credit qualification that is meaningful and allows them to move on. We've invested in parent toolkits that help parents to ask the questions of their child's teacher and of their child that ensures that they are getting what they need. much more focused on how the system fits to the young person rather than the young person necessarily fitting the system. As part of our quality teaching agenda, as the Prime Minister's already indicated, the biggest announcement was the one we made earlier this year on the $359 million investing into career pathways. The working group met for the first time last week. They are very engaged in this process and very keen to be involved in the design features, which I'm expecting them to report back sometime in April. In addition, we've set loose a task force on regulations because we want to see whether there is just undue compliance that is constraining or fettering schools from being able to get on and teach. And so we expect to find those regulations and get rid of them or streamline them to create more operational space. The network for learning, we've had significant, as you might imagine, uptake from schools who want to be connected to that so that their young people can be more involved in digital learning. As the Prime Minister's already indicated, we have also invested in new legislation for the body, and I expect to be introducing that in the next week. These results have come increasingly off the back of targeting and working with students. They represent the trends that we've had for the last 5 years, and we expect that trend to keep going. And finally, that is to say that all secondary schools have an achievement profile now. They know what their last 5 years looked like by gender, by ethnicity, by subject, and they know what their next 5 years look like in terms of where they want to get to with the kids going to their school. NCEA results we're announcing today are different from our BPS results. The BPS results deal with 18-year-olds. These results today deal with kids who may be 18 but are still in the compulsory school system. This is good news.
The 26% or 23%, do we know where they are going? The ones that don't sort of achieve that level 2, they're going to trade?
We know that we are reducing the numbers that are in the needs category. They're not in employment, not in education, not in training. There are more pathways available for young people, whether that's through Youth Guarantee or through the Youth Transition Service that's operated by Social Development. We've got quite a big initiative that we are starting this year called Count Me In, which is how do we make sure that kids at year 7, 8, 9 and 10 stay engaged with education so that they're still there in order to do NCEA 1 and 2. But it is true, we have got a challenge. The 4% increase for Māori, for instance, is still to 59%. That's way better than the 44% it was in 2008, but we've still got a way to go.
So do you have empirical evidence to show that the schools that had these targeted programs have had the accelerated increase in achievement?
Yes, we have, from their own reporting. But the results we're announcing today are the national aggregate results. They're not yet at specific school level because there is still some marginal moving around for kids, for instance, who are checking their particular grade, though that kind of participation information matched against the NGQA results. But those schools themselves are already reporting that they have had a lift as a result of focusing on this data. Well, there are just over 400 secondary schools. I'm not sure what proportion of that are area schools, for instance. In the first year, which was 2012 with this methodology, we did a very small sample of 16 schools and we saw a significant increase in the achievement rate there. I think the number of schools we did in 2013 worked with directly, all other schools are obviously working to get through NCEA as well, would have been about 130. So that would be over a quarter of all secondary schools. We're getting to the point where the methodology speaks for itself and principals themselves are using it together with what's already working in their schools.
Is it broken down by decile?
I beg your pardon?
Is it broken down by decile at all?
So none of this is provisional NCEA information at the aggregate national level today. We will be able to dig deeper into that over the next few weeks. So I expect that we will able to absolutely do all of that, but that's not what this information allows us to do today.
And at a wider level, what role does the business cycle have, do you think, in reducing producing these improved figures.
Can you clarify what you mean?
Well, in 2008, you're coming off a boom where there would be an attraction for teenagers to go into the workforce because the economy is in reasonably good shape. During a recession, there's a corresponding impetus for them to stay in school and attain higher qualifications. So I just wondered whether there's any way you could quantify the impact of that normal business cycle fluctuation.
So what we do know, if you look at where, let's just take Māori as an indicator, they were at 44% pre the, you know, the GFC, and they're at 58% now. That has been a result of both staying at school longer and being engaged in a program that fits them and having pathways that lead to give visibility to what job or opportunity they might have, and parental engagement with it. In fact, we still have a problem with too many young, mainly boys, leaving before NCEA 1. So these numbers are relate to the kids who set NCEA 2.
I'm sure. I was just wondering whether your job is made easier if there's a recession which is telling parents and telling kids you better stay in school and get those qualifications.
Well, I hope that parents are telling their kids to stay in school. I don't know, to come back to your original answer, how much of this can be argued around recessionary times, but we've put a lot of effort in as a government engaging and keeping kids at school. And a lot more are staying at school. Yes, it coincides with that period, but that's because even before that, before the GFC, we had too many kids disengaging from the system.
By definition, go the other way, though. I mean, if the economic environment is strong, then it's actually easier for youngsters to leave school and find a job with lower levels of qualification.
That was my point. Actually, in 2008.
Well, I think that now what shows it's actually harder to do it when the economic conditions have been tougher, because by definition, more and more children are actually staying at school, and therefore we've got a much broader sample, so we're actually doing better under that measure.
Yeah, that was the point I was making.
But and there are
other jobs might be being done for you by the recession.
Well, it's the opposite, isn't it? I mean, if your argument is it's somehow easier because of a recession, I think it's actually harder because of a recession, because by definition your denominator is becoming larger, and you have to get, because this is a percentage achievement, you actually have to do better under that environment because you've got a bigger cohort of kids in school. Okay, thanks, Lahiki. Yep. Just moving into the House this week, the government intends to progress the taxation annual rates, foreign superannuation remedial matters bill, and the student loan scheme amendment bill number 3. Wednesday is a members' day, and on Thursday morning we'll have extended hours to progress some of the Treaty of Waitangi legislation. In terms of my own activities this week, I'm in Wellington today, tomorrow and Wednesday. And Nelson on Thursday. I'm travelling to the Coromandel on Friday. Questions?
Just on alcohol and voting, do you think it's time to create legislation around the two?
I think it's worthy of having a look at the issue, and I know that the Recreational Voting Forum is going to report back to the government in April. But, you know, if I would caution how easy it would be to really have legislation in this area. It is vastly different to patrol the seas than it is the roads. We certainly want to get that message very strongly out there, that if you drink and then you captain a boat, that's a really silly thing to do. And, of course, by definition, if you get off your boat and get in your car as a result of a day's drinking on the seas, you may well be in breach of the alcohol limits, which, of course, are coming down. But, look, overall, I just don't think it's nearly as easy as people say to actually administer that on the high seas.
Are there other ways of perhaps stomping down on boating strikers?
Well, you can educate people, and there's some argument that people say, well, you should test people when they're at the marinas, but it's all just not quite as straightforward as people say.
Wouldn't it send the right signal just by making a drinking level, though, even if it's difficult for police?
Well, I think, like anything, if you're going to make a law like that, the expectation will be on the government to administer that law, and the cost and the practicality of that make it quite challenging.
Have you had any advice in the past from, you know, the Transport Accident Commission, those sorts of people, about whether or not you need something like this?
Well, I think the boating, I haven't looked at the advice, but I'm pretty sure the boating forum, Recreational Boating Forum, actually advised the government back in 2007 that they believe they should make changes in this area. The then Labor government chose not to follow that path. As I say, let's see what the advice looks like in April this year.
To your mind, is there any way of preventing accidents like the one we saw at Kilmore?
we'd certainly like to. I mean, there's a lot we can do around education, and you've seen that, for instance, with life jackets, where you've seen high-profile New Zealanders running a campaign to encourage people to put on a life jacket. And we want to send a very strong signal that it's no more sensible to be driving a boat intoxicated than it is driving a car. I'm just simply saying, practically, it is a lot easier to control the roads in one sense because it's a discrete environment than the high seas.
On Christchurch City Council, Dan Dalzell today just reiterated again this concern that she has about the Christchurch Council being locked into that binding agreement with the government on those anchor projects. Will you let the council out of that agreement so they can renegotiate it?
Well, that's not our intention. I mean, our intention is to make sure that we do the very best for Christchurch. And one of the reasons there was a separation of those anchor projects was because it was deemed to be easier if the council, for instance, controlled in totality some projects and we control others. And by definition, we play the part in financing a bit of all of the projects, and they had some resources for a bit of all the projects generally from their insurance claim. Mr. Brownlee is constantly having discussions and meetings with the Mayor of Christchurch. I'm sure those discussions will continue. We're not trying to do anything other than be hugely helpful for the people of Christchurch, but practically the government is putting in an enormous amount of resources, and it's only logical that the council will have to put some on its own.
But they're saying they've got a problem, they're not going to be able to meet their end of the bargain. I mean, are you saying you won't let them out of that binding agreement?
It's not a matter of letting them out. I mean, those anchor projects are critical to the future of Christchurch. My understanding is that the deal that was struck was one that was a fair one that reflected both their capacity to make those payments and the insurance proceeds that they received. Now, you know, there are always ongoing discussions, but you know, my view is that we struck a deal. I think it's the right one. And, you know, there's some incredibly compelling reasons I'm reluctant to change.
I mean, she clearly needs to write a new deal.
Well, does she? I mean, we don't know that.
She also said in her speech more broadly that there's still a way to go to rebuild the relationship between the council and central government. What's your view of the relationship? How is it going at the moment?
I think the relationship's strong. I mean, my understanding is Gerry's been meeting with Leanne regularly. I saw her in Christchurch at the New Zealand Open, had a, you know, the discussion with her. I invite her to all the events that I host in Christchurch where it would be practical. I'm more than happy to have discussions with her. I meet with quite a lot of their councillors.
So why do you think she holds that view?
Look, I can't speak for her, and I actually don't think the previous government and council relationship was necessarily bad. I think we need to put it in the context of this is a $40+ billion rebuild of one of New Zealand's major cities, and there'll always be some tension and some challenges, but for the most part I think it's progressing quite well.
Last week David kind of used your house as an attack point in the house. He said that you lived in a leaky suburb. Would you describe Hearn Bay in the same way?
The limited knowledge I have of Hearn Bay, yeah, it sounds like a pretty leafy place from the, well, it looks like a pretty leafy place from the time I've spent driving around.
And it's not the first time he's used your mansion, as I say, as an attack point, and yet he lives in a multi-million-dollar house himself. Is that hypocritical to you?
Well, I think he should just be proud of where he lives. I assume he likes his neighbours and his neighbourhood. You know, MPs are free to live wherever they want. I don't make any secret of where I live. Delight my street, my neighbours, and the place I live.
Is it hypocrisy, though, to attack someone for living in a multi-million-dollar house if they, in turn, live in a multi-million-dollar house?
Well, I'll let you judge that. I haven't seen the footage of his house, so I can't comment.
And what do you mean when you kind of insinuated now and last week that he perhaps isn't proud of his house, perhaps ashamed of his house?
Well, I haven't seen his house, so I can't comment. I have limited knowledge I have of Hearn Bay. It's a very lovely, expensive part of Auckland. But in the end, if he's attacking me for living in a leafy suburb, it seems a little odd if he's living in one himself, and one can only assume he's doing that for political reasons. But it's for him to defend his own home, his own environment. I certainly don't attack him for that. If he and his wife have done well, then that's actually what I want every New Zealander to strive to achieve.
Prime Minister, when you say at the weekend you were... You know, you didn't do your supermarket shopping at the weekend, but if you had, not only would you not have boycotted Count, and you would have made a point of going there.
Correct.
Why? That's
Not because I don't think there's a good case to look at. That's the whole purpose of the Commerce Commission having an inquiry, and we've certainly been encouraging them to have an inquiry. My point I made on the radio this morning is these are unsubstantiated claims, and I've said a couple of times, I think that actually in fairness to Countdown and the many thousands and thousands of jobs which are supported by Countdown buying those products from the very strong point that actually the onus and responsibility on the MP is to make sure they're absolutely right. And he may be. I hope for the sake of countdown and consumers and suppliers, he's not right. But he may well be right. I'm not saying he is or isn't. It's his story to run. I'm just simply saying they're unsubstantiated. And from the point that he made those comments last Wednesday, he has refused to repeat them outside the House.
Colin Craig's threatening defamation action against Russell Norman. Does Colin Craig need to harden up a bit when it comes to politics?
Well, he's got lots of lawyers if he comes into Parliament. It's going to be a busy time for him.
What do you make of moves like that? Is it worth as wild as the publicity stunt? What do you think of this?
Well, I've been around for 12 years and I've never bothered suing anybody. I mean, what a waste of time.
Do you think he needs a thicker skin?
I don't know. Look, it's a matter for him. But, I mean, honestly, my experience of it, if I start taking legal action every time I feel that someone wronged me, my lawyers would be busy too.
Have you had worse said about
you? You'd all be on the other end of it, I'm sure.
Have you had worse said about you?
Oh, God, I believe so. Yep.
We've, as part of the poll that we did at the weekend, we've asked the question of party supporters who they would like their party of choice to go into coalition.
Oh, yeah.
And Colin Craig is fairly well down the list of National Party choices. Does that surprise you?
Not really. I mean, I think if you ask National supporters, probably their number one choice would be that we go into alone. In reality, that's the nature of MMP is such that you need to literally cobble together a coalition, and they may not always be the number one preferences of your supporters. So look, in the end, we're going to do our best to try and deliver a result that looks like your poll did on Saturday, but I think we all know that the nature of MMP is such that we will have to work with other political parties. All I can say is that I hold very strongly to the view that the bigger your party vote, the more influence we will have in that situation, and the less influence those coalition partners will
be. They actually prefer the Greens over the Conservatives. Does that surprise you?
Not really. I've seen those before, but I genuinely believe that people who are aligning, when they hear the word Green, environmental policy, and not looking at all of the other things that the Greens said.
Who would you expect the party that the first choice of National supporters to be in the coalition?
Acton, might be.
The Green Party's vowing to sell off your prized Beamers if they were elected and replace them with hybrids. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, firstly, they were Helen's Beamers. She bought them as a going-away present for me. And the basic point there is that they were bought because they were environmentally friendly. So, look, I don't know if technology's moved. I don't know if someone can produce a deal that looks anything like that. But the last time we looked at this contract, which was all around the 2011 campaign, the reason that the government renewed that contract, which was established literally by Helen, was because it was such a fantastic deal. I mean, BMW basically provides, what is well below commercial rates to have the government take those cars. If there's something that's more environmentally friendly and presents as good a deal to the government, let's have a look at it, but I don't believe anyone will.
The contract's up for renewal, and I think next year, you said in 2011, 3 years' time. Are you looking at replacing the fleet of Beamers with Toyota Priuses or Holden Bolts?
Not at the moment. I mean, look, in the end, they'd have to do a few things. One, it'd have to be the same sort of economic impact for the Crown, which, as I said, if you go back and look at my comments in 2011, it's a very, very, very good deal for the state. The second thing is, practically, these cars are actually used to ferry international visitors. They're a workplace. I spend a lot of time in the back of those cars, working. I just don't know whether those other cars can do that. They may be able to, but you're asking the wrong guy. I'm not a good car guy.
Do they need to be luxury cars, though? I mean, just the status that they are used for, do they need to be expensive?
Well, at the rate the Crown pays for them, they are not luxury. Luxury is cars, but we pay next to nothing for them, so they're not luxury.
But would it be appropriate to have a Prius or something?
Well, if it costs us twice or three times what a BMW costs us, we'd be selling it in the state to do.
What happens if you've got a good deal on some Priuses? 34 Priuses. Would you go with that?
34 Priuses. Well, come and show me the deal. In the end, it's not my decision. DIA make the decision. They run it. It would have to meet all of the criteria and the cost. All I'm saying is that BMW will, by country mile, might love it.
In 2011, you said that that was one of your proudest things you've done, was the deal you got for the Beamers. I think you said in the 2011 election campaign. Have you got anything like that coming up next year?
I'd have to look at the context. Like I said, I don't think it would be one of the proudest things I've done, but the point I was making was Helen Clark signed New Zealand up to a deal. It did have a review clause, if you like, after 3 years. But actually, we looked at it, and it was a fabulous deal. So,
can I ask you something?
I'm not going to jump over a court process. That's before the courts. We intend to treat the matter professionally as you would expect us to, and that is allow the courts to do their work, and then there'll be the point at which the Justice Minister is required legally to assess whether they followed due process and accurately followed the law.
But you criticised Russell Morgan last week for even countenancing, overturning.
That's my exact point, and I don't intend to make the case the other way.
Well, the corollary is that.
Well, my point is, it's going to go through the court process. When the court determines, and the Minister of Justice, independently, or whatever I might think, needs to make a decision, and I'll leave that to her.
But your reading of the situation is that prerogative could go either way. That's what I think the point Audrey's making.
Well, look, I don't know that's right. I mean, there's a legal process, but the matter's before the courts, and politicians that jump in front of the cameras and tell New Zealanders they're going to overrule one way or
the
other.
No, that's not the question. The question is whether the powers under the law enable the minister to...
Well, I don't know the answer. Yeah, to check the Justice Minister.
But isn't it the case that if the minister can override the decision to extradite, the Congress would be true?
Maybe, but you did check with you, I don't know.
It's a steel mill in Auckland that's going to close down, and the union says it's because the Christchurch people is using imported steel.
Which one is it?
It's Fletcher's.
It's not closing, they're selling it to BlueScope, and there's no job done, as I said.
They said that the mill will close down by next year, the steel. So should
is it the same one as the one they announced this week, Fletcher's announced this one?
Yeah.
Look, I haven't had a really good look at it. My understanding is that BlueScope are buying it. That's an example of them expanding their investments because they already owned what was the old New Zealand Steel mill in Auckland. There's no job losses, and it's actually a sign of them expanding their footprint in New Zealand. So maybe they're bringing it on site, I don't really know. It's the one they're buying from Fletcher's, that's my understanding.
Should they be using New Zealand steel in the rebuilding question?
Again, the limited amount I know about steel, we don't produce all the steel in New Zealand that's actually required, so we do import some. In the end, actually, also, consumers want the best price, so New Zealand companies have to be able to compete. And as you can see by BlueScope, they wouldn't be buying a New Zealand mill and expanding their footprint unless they believe they could produce steel that can compete with an imported product.
Did Cabinet discuss the flag today?
No.
What did Cabinet discuss today? Because this is a post-Cabinet press one. I don't think you mentioned anything that was discussed in Cabinet.
Well, could do, but you didn't ask me a specific question, but now you have. I look at a wide range of flags. I'm going to go through every single bit, but there was a bunch of treaty legislation, wide-ranging other things to do with the budget.
When do you expect to make a decision on the flag?
Within the month or so.
It's correct that David Cameron had in the House last week about Parnell. It's not the first time he's done that. Why do you think he keeps bringing up where you live?
He must think there's a particular reason why that will electorally benefit him. I personally don't think it does. I've never made a secret of where I live. And in the end, actually, I haven't made a secret of the fact that I've had a successful business career prior to coming into Parliament. I think in the last 5.5 years as Prime Minister, I've actually proven that some of those skills can benefit New Zealand. And actually, whoever is going to be Prime Minister of New Zealand, I hope they can bring good skills to the job.
You said he doesn't want his supporters to know he lives in Herne Bay. Why do you say that?
Well, because that can be the only reason that he doesn't want to talk about it, I suppose.
Just one quick question on Countdown. If those allegations were validated, are you confident that the Commerce Commission has adequate powers to investigate such?
Well, I think they've got adequate powers, but the question would be what would happen next. And of course, there would be major implications of that. And there still may be as a result of the inquiry, even if the allegations that Mr. Jones has proven not to be correct, there may be other actions that follow. I don't know. But what I do know is that we should all sort of hold our water, so to speak, until we actually know the facts.
On the issue of market power, the Productivity Commission has said the government should strengthen that legislation to prosecute the issue of market power to try and improve productivity and reduce prices and things. What's the government's view on those, that call for reform of Section 36?
Well, I can't recall the advice I've seen on it, but I mean, look, at the end of the day, as I said this morning, I think everyone accepts that when it comes to small suppliers and dominant supermarkets, there's a power imbalance. Now, I suspect when the inquiry takes place, there will be suppliers who say that they feel the pressure of that power imbalance. Whether that actually marries up to what Mr. Jones is saying is quite a different issue.
You say that you think the Commission's got adequate powers. Do you think it's got adequate resources?
It hasn't. Well, no one's brought to my attention that it doesn't have the resources to carry that out. If they did, then we would have a look at that.
What do New Zealand food producers say to you about the supermarkets in New Zealand?
Well, they're aggressive purchasers, and they're a dominant force between the two of them. And the vast bulk of consumer items, when it comes to groceries and the likes, are bought through supermarkets. So obviously, at one level, the supermarkets drive a very hard bargain. Now, if you think about that, consumers, by and large, benefit from that. And the reason they benefit, of course, is that their margins aren't